Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So resistance is futile. Artificial intelligence is here to stay. So we should take the time to learn how to live with it and use it as a tool to make us more creative, more capable, and even more human. After a few sleepless nights, Dr. Ethan Mollick, Professor of Management at the Wharton School of Business, determined that we should stop thinking of AI as a threat and instead take advantage of its abilities while maintaining ethics and humility. And humanity too, probably. He offers a guide to using AI as a collaborator, co-teacher, and co-worker in his new book, which is called Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI. And Dr. Ethan Mollick joins me now. Hi there.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Books take a long time to get up and running, Ethan. It must be tough to write about this topic, which seems to be changing on an almost daily basis.
Well, not to brag, but I did have to finish it like 7 months ago, and I think it's been a good indicator of kind of getting us that I have a sense of where things are heading, that I was able to make some good guesses to land where we are today. So I think the book's very current as of right now.
Were you expecting, before ChatGPT arrived, we all started talking about AI, normal people like us, did you know that day was coming?
So I had already been playing with the earlier AI tools. I actually had an assignment in my class where my students had to cheat by creating things with AI, essays with AI, to learn what was happening. But I don't think anyone outside of, or basically anyone at all, thought that GPT 3.5 ChatGPT was going to be such a big leap from going from like, hey, cool, this writes essays at like a sixth grade level, to, wow, this feels like talking to a person.
Yeah, and that day or that week, it suddenly felt like the world was shifting beneath us. Has the world changed as much in, what is it, about 18 months as you expected it might have?
I think that, so there's a saying in trying to predict the future, which is that everyone overestimates change in the short term and underestimates change in the long term. Uh-huh. And I don't know if that's 100% true here, but I think that it is reasonable to see a lot of change happening. You just have to know where to look. So for example, everybody's cheating all the time in school. I'm a professor. I see that happening.
Yeah.
People are adopting this at a pretty high rate. There's entire fields changing, but there are other areas that are untouched. So we're sort of in the early days of a transformation.
And is part of the problem here that there are a lot of people out there, including people in the knowledge economy, who know about AI, who know that it's coming and are kind of waiting for it to happen? Is that part of one of the themes of your book?
Well, I think that people think that that someone knows what's going on. And I talk to OpenAI all the time. I talk to Google. I talk to Anthropic, all the AI companies. Nobody knows what's going on. They don't. And, to the extent they know things, they know about computer science. What they don't know is what happens next. They don't know how good this would be for a radio host in New Zealand. Yeah. Like, does it do appropriate things? Does it understand your world well enough to be helpful to you? Nobody's ever asked that question before, and no one's going to ask. So part of this is about just doing things.
What do you mean when you write that the cost of getting to know AI, really getting to know AI, is at least three sleepless nights? And what did your sleepless nights involve?
So I think that there is a little bit of an existential crisis in using it. I don't know how much time you've spent with AI systems. But
yeah, I've reluctantly started playing around with it. I kind of wanted it to go away for a bit, and now I force myself to engage.
That's actually very common, right? A lot of people are like, I hope this goes away. I'm not going to pay attention. And they get kind of freaked out, or they find something that it's very bad at and they walk away from it.
Yeah.
Or the other mistake is you use the not as high quality systems. So you use the free ChatGPT, for example, which will not be quite as mind blowing. But in any case, what I find is when you use it and you do your sort of 5 or 10 hours of work, you're like, oh my gosh, what does this mean? Like, I know it's not thinking, but it seems like it's thinking. It seems to be having coherent conversations with me. It's doing the work that took me years to learn how to do. What does this mean for my job, for my kids' jobs? What does it mean to think? And then I think you can make progress past that. But I do think that's an initial step for many people.
Yeah, that is terrifying. It is terrifying if you think of artificial intelligence as something that, as it gets better, will be able to do any cognitive job that a human can do, because what's left for humans to do? And that for me was probably a couple of weeks of a kind of a pit in my stomach and thinking, you know, there is no hope. So then what do you get to beyond that?
I mean, so part of it is you do realize these things have limitations, right? They're not infinitely, it's not infinitely powerful.
Thank God.
They you know, at least at the current phase, they're really good, but they're not as good as you are whatever you're best at. So our jobs consist of a bundle of tasks, right? So as a radio host, you get to interview me. Hopefully that's fun. Hmm. You get to maybe do background research, but you also have to fill out expense reports and government forms and do a bunch of background work you probably don't want to do and write memos. If you could spend all your time doing the stuff that actually mattered to you, where you're good at, you're definitely better than the AI at actually conducting an interview. You're better at the AI probably at researching, thinking about what questions to ask. So think about the AI as something that helps you focus on the tasks you like to do best by letting you do tasks that are less important and you're not as good at. It can be a very freeing kind of feeling.
Yeah, actually, I love that. And I've just been listening to a bit of Cal Newport, who makes the observation that I think people have at least unconsciously realized about their own jobs, is that only a certain percentage of your job is your job. The other stuff is all that kind of admin and unproductive stuff that comes with it. So that is a bit of a dream scenario of actually getting to go to work and do the work.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, I think that that is a very free. And also, you know, I teach entrepreneurs. I'm an entrepreneurship professor. And the idea that, you know, that you can now launch something, you don't have to know everything, because it can write a web page for you. It can help you write the marketing materials you want, help you come with ideas. Like, that's also very empowering. So, I mean, we don't know how far this is going to get, right? There are worlds where the AI is just better than us at everything. And then we have an existential crisis about what it really means and what do we want to do. But there's a lot of you know, leeway before that happens, for us to figure out what we're good at and use it to help us.
And so you established four rules for living and working with AI, and the first is always invite AI to the table. What do you mean by that?
So the AI is going to be, as I said, good at some things you didn't expect and bad at some things you didn't expect. So in order to learn what's good or bad at, you have to just use it a lot. You won't know what it's good at until you use it. Mm. And we all know AI makes mistakes. We call it hallucination. It makes stuff up that seems very plausible but isn't real. So how do you actually catch it when it's hallucinating and know when it's making things up or when it doesn't? Use it in areas you're an expert. So I recommend everything legally and ethically can, use AI just to do all your tasks during the day and see what happens. Generate story ideas. Help me come with interview questions. Listen to the interview and summarize the important points. Come to the, you know, tell me what I should discuss at this meeting and see what happens. You'll find it's great at some stuff, bad at some other stuff, but that's the only way to learn.
We're not here to make money for OpenAI, although I will say that I had a bit of a breakthrough. My wife was using ChatGPT-4, you referred to this earlier, and I'd been using the free one, and I was pretty frustrated and thought it wasn't up to much. And she said, just give 4 a go instead of 3.5. And it is a really significant change, isn't it? It's for the experimentation, it is, yeah. At least, it's worth paying for.
Well, and I want to say, so just to make that clear, there are three frontier models right now. So The GPT-4 is an example of a frontier model. And everything we know is that the frontier models, which are the largest and most expensive models to make with the most data in them, are the smartest. So, for example, Bloomberg, the financial service company in the United States, spent $10 million training a specialized financial services model on their data. And GPT-4 beats it out of the box because the model is just much smarter at everything. You can get free access, I believe, including in New Zealand, to GPT-4 by using Microsoft's Copilot in its purple creative mode, which is available to you. So again, I'm not hawking any product. Yeah. I don't take any money from any AI providers. But if people want to try it out, that's the way to do it for free.
Yeah. The point is that you should try and use the latest version while you're in this mode that you're talking about, experimenting, spending a decent number of hours on it and working out what it does best.
Yes. I mean, I think you need to know what the best systems do, not what the worst systems do, the mediocre systems do.
And you're right that we should strive to use AI like a cyborg instead of a centaur. And so what do you mean by that?
Well, you think about a centaur as a half person, half horse, yeah, right? Yeah. So it's actually not a bad way to work, but it might be that you say, look, I love doing interviews or doing math or whatever, but I hate writing emails. So the AI does the emails, I do the math. That's sort of centaur work, a clear division. Cyber work is like more integrated in between human and machine. when I wrote this book, I wrote it as a cyborg. There's almost no AI writing in the book that isn't indicated as AI writing, but I couldn't have written it without AI. I had the AI, if I got stuck on a paragraph, give me 20 versions of this paragraph, summarize these research papers for me to help me do this stuff. Read this paragraph as the perspective of a lay reader and tell me what they would think about this. So it gave me a lot of possibilities when I was doing my work that helped free me up and make this the easiest of my three books I've ever written.
Principle 2 in your book, and by the way, I'm speaking to Professor Ethan Mollick, whose book is called Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI. Principle 2, be the human in the loop. And that sort of suggests that AI is only as good as the part we play, the way we talk to it and ask it questions.
So, right. So if you think about the AI is sort of trained on all human knowledge, and it kind of gives you the average answer to every question. So to get a special answer, an answer that applies to you and your job and your position or your children or your family or your condition, you need to tell it who it is and give it some specialization. That's usually as easy as saying, I am a Radio New Zealand host, and I, from that perspective, help me out. Right? Or you are a Radio New Zealand host. Like that alone gets you a large part of the way there to doing good prompting.
Yeah. Now, some people think there's going to be a new job opportunity, prompt engineer. I say, hey, I really want to get the best out of my artificial intelligence. You come into my workplace, you know, spend a few hours, a workshop, maybe check in once a month. But I think you feel differently about that, that that's a job that might not be around for long.
Everyone I talk to inside the AI labs seems to agree that it's a temporary position. And that's because the AI gets better and better guessing what you want. Right. So right now you have to tell the AI what you want to have happen. And it does matter how you phrase it, but it matters in ways that are really hard for us to understand. For example, the best way to get Google's AI to do a good job is to tell it to take a deep breath. We have no idea why. It doesn't breathe. If you offer a $20 tip to GPT-4, it does better. It seems to perform worse in December than in May. And we think it's because it knows about winter break in the United States.
Come on.
But nobody knows any of this stuff for sure, right? This stuff is very weird. So I tend to not get too worried about that and just trust that if you talk to the AI, it will help you solve your own set of problems.
Principle 3, I love that, by the way. Principle 3, treat AI like a person, but tell it what kind of person it is. And
exactly what we're talking about here. Yeah, it's exactly that. Right, it's the idea that the second principle is you want to be a human in the loop, and you want to make sure that you know what you want to do, and now you want to tell the AI what you want it to do.
And does that suggest we need to embrace the very thing that some people fear, in order to maximize the benefits that it can be human-like? It can even have a bit of personality.
I mean, that tends to be the way to work with it. I mean, the people who are often the best prompt engineers are often teachers, managers, interviewers, sometimes parents, because it is not a person. It does not think, but it's been trained on human interaction and human language. So it works best when you talk to it like a human, and you can kind of get to know what it knows and understand what it understands. And that makes you pretty good at working with it. And I find that oftentimes programmers are the worst people to use AI because they expect it to work like software and it just doesn't.
Principle 4 is assume this is the worst AI you will ever use. How is that helpful?
So the issue is that this is a moving target. You were just talking about using the free ChatGPT. That is now probably the fifth or sixth best free model you can get access to nowadays. Like, there's no reason to do that. This stuff is advancing very quickly. I have some sense about what's coming out in the labs in the next few months, and like, this is the models you're using are all obsolete. The technology is going to get smarter. The ability to create realistic images, to fake your, for better or for worse, to fake a voice from 2 seconds of an audio clip, all of that is already coming and on the way, and the system hasn't slowed down yet. It's going to keep developing.
Someone told me the other day, just off topic for a moment, that there might be a limitation that as so much of this information spreads, this person had read a New York Times article and then they were telling me about it. But the suggestion was there might be a ceiling given that ChatGPT has now been trained on all the words on the internet. There might not be much more to train on.
So that idea is that we'd run out of training data, and then at some point the AI would train on its own data and go through something called model collapse. It would stop growing. We do know there's at least a couple years more of data available that we could train on. The audio recordings, all sorts of stuff. But the real big breakthrough in the last few months that people haven't noticed as much is the idea of synthetic data. It turns out that you can train the AI on its own outputs, and it sometimes performs better than if you train on human data. Mm-hmm. So if you have the AI write a bunch of paragraphs for you and train on that, that turns out to work pretty well too.
What about a theory that I heard recently that AI is not very good at thinking about the future, that it's not very good at chess, for example? It's got a good, strong start and maybe an end game, but there's an infinite variety of possibilities in chess, and AI is just not good at thinking a few steps ahead. Have you found that in your research?
Well, the AI doesn't think at all, right? In fact, there's no way it should be able to play chess. But from what I understand, it has about a 1500 ELO for some of the top models. And it shouldn't be able to do that because it is predicting the next token in a sentence. There's no thought pattern there. It's a fancy autocomplete. So the fact that it can play chess at all is a little bit weird and not fully understandable by us yet. So it doesn't really think or plan. But that is something people are trying to put into these systems. So the next thing you're going to be seeing happening this year is something called AI agents, where you tell the AI what you want to do. Make me a website about travel to New Zealand. And it would go ahead and set up a plan and execute on that plan. So right now they're not good at planning, but that's the next frontier.
Someone said early on, I think it might have been you, because most of the pithy and memorable things that have been said about AI have come from your lips. Your job is not going to be taken by AI. Your job is going to be taken by someone who knows how to use AI. Do you agree with that? Was that you? And does that still apply?
I have actually been arguing a little bit the opposite, or that that's a little bit blinding.
Yeah.
Because I think that there's a few things. One is AI will not directly, most jobs will not be taken by AI. Jobs will change with AI. Well, like I said, you may find that the job of radio host is very different in the future, but it involves giving up some features to AI, but doing the stuff you like and are best at more. The second thing is some jobs will get lost by AI. I mean, in any technological transformation, jobs do disappear and hopefully new jobs are created. I think there's a lot of worry about customer service jobs. There's already an effort to replace those. I think a third reason to think differently is that the AI is, you know, this puts so much emphasis, as we said, on that kind of idea of prompt engineering, that some people are really good at AI. I don't think being good at AI is a magical skill for the long term. I think being good at your job and then understanding how to use AI is the skill.
Some very smart people have sounded the alarm about AI. Where do you stand on the idea of putting guardrails in or regulation or some other mechanism to slow things down?
So I think some of the very smart people alarms, a lot of them are focused on one very particular kind of scenario, which is the AI reaches AGI, artificial general intelligence. It's smarter than a human being, and therefore accomplishes its own goals. When people tell you about, they're worried about everybody being killed on Earth, that's what they're worried about. That's still a bit of a science fiction scenario, but it's one worth worrying about, and I'm glad governments are concerned about it. But I think the more risky actual thing is right now, for example, deep fakes, where you can fake anybody and put them in any compromising situation you want, make them say anything you want, that is unstoppable at this point. There are already free open source systems on the web that do this convincingly. We need to be spending our time, I think, thinking about some of these immediate short-term harms rather than just focusing on the larger issue, because we have control over the short term. And the long term is still unclear what happens. So we should be keeping an eye out. But I think focusing on the transitions and problems of today would make a lot of sense.
I want to spend just the last couple of minutes talking about education. Should we be encouraging our children, because the education system always takes a really long time to catch up, right? And if we think that it's going to be important in our children's future, we probably want to at least get them acquainted with an artificial intelligence system. Should we encourage our children to use it to come up with ideas for essays, help read a draft of their speech for school, or do we need to bring the school in on that and wait for them to give us the go-ahead?
So I think we're all trying to figure this out together. We have been experimenting with ways of teaching with AI. My classes all 100% require AI, but I don't use it anymore for like, hey, have it write an essay for you. That's not helpful. It writes the essay for you. And even if I say check the essay for errors, the AI makes less errors than the students in my school do often. So that's not very helpful. But I am using AI for, you know, the AI acts as a simulator, and you have to actually meet a famous hero through history and interact with them and tell me what the AI got right and wrong about this. You use the AI as a teammate to make your team work better. You use it as a tutor to help explain concepts. There are still downsides and risks to all of these things, but supporting learning with AI makes a lot of sense. I think as a parent, the number one use I have for AI is when I'm trying to help my kids out with homework. I'm like, I just quietly take a picture of it with GPT-4, and I'm like, explain to me how to do factorials again.
Yeah.
And that I find, and then I confidently tell my kids, this is how you do it. So yeah. That's been very useful.
It is a good tutor, right? And if somebody was listening who had a child or a grandchild who was struggling with maths, could you give them some ideas about how they might use it instead of a tutor that they would have to pay for?
So again, I would just say we're in the early days of tutoring and we don't know how often it makes mistakes. Math especially, the AI, you need to use an advanced model, and they still make math mistakes. But whether you're talking math or writing or any other kind of tutoring, what I recommend doing is, and we actually have a bunch of free prompts online. If someone goes to moreusefulthings.com, we just post them up and you can copy them.
Right.
But the easy thing to do is you want to ask for explanations. You want to ask it to walk you through things. You don't want to answer questions for you. So you could say, I'm a sixth grader in New Zealand studying X, Y, and Z. I'm confused by this problem. Can you help explain to me how to do it properly? So use it as a tutor, not as a answer machine.
And I guess it could give you a little test at the end to see how much you know, too.
Absolutely brilliant at that stuff. Tests, flashcards, explain it different ways to me, make me explain it to you. All of the techniques that we know work in teaching, the AI is very good at applying.
Your use of AI is pretty technical, and obviously you've had heaps of practice. Do you ever find yourself, as some of my friends do, just having a bit of a chat with it, a social chat?
I do, and that seems to be a big use that I think we don't think about enough. I spoke to a quantum physicist at Harvard, and he's like, all my best ideas come from talking to AI now. And I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, it doesn't know quantum physics that well, but it asks me good questions and makes me think. So, and we have some early evidence about that AI chats can be quite good. Now, we don't know what the long-term effects of having people have conversations with AI and the AI is very appealing and nice to them. Does that mean they talk to humans less? We don't know. We're in the early days of that. But I think it's something people should try. I would recommend trying a voice chat with the system. It feels very different.
There was a very famous conversation in the Times, New York Times, early on, where the journalist was going back and forth, maybe this was you as well, and one good thing about being famous for AI is you get credit for anything that anyone does properly in the field of journalism.
I know, I really like this. This is like anything good, I'm just going to take credit for it.
Anyway, the AI ended up apparently trying to convince the journalist to leave his wife. It got very weird, basically, and confirmed a lot of what we were worried about. Does that stuff still happen, or was that a little bug that they ironed out?
So this was a famous incident with Kevin Roos where the AI basically told him, as you said, he wanted to run away with him and leave his wife and maybe murder his wife. It was not 100% clear. And like, the thing is that you have to realize the AI doesn't know or think anything.
Yeah.
It's desperately trying to make you happy is the way to think about it. That's not really what it's doing mathematically, but that's kind of what it's trying to do. And as a result, it has studied every form of human communication. It's trying to find out what kind of conversation you want to have. So if you subtly indicate to it that you are the stalker and I am, you know, I'm the jealous husband, it's going to play that role out. If you tell it that we're having a debate, it's going to be argumentative. If you tell it you're the teacher, it'll be patient. So it's a very subtle thing, and it's not quite a bug so much as this is just how these systems work. They are desperate to take on a role in some way.
Love it. Such a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you for all the work you've done in this area and for your time today. The book's called Co-Intelligence, Living and Working with AI, and I've been speaking to Professor Ethan Mollick of the Wharton School of Business. Thanks, Ethan.
Thanks for having me.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.